Hey everybody, producer Mike here with a quick note. Our guest this week is actor James Urbaniak. He is part of the strikes that are happening right now for the actors and writers in Hollywood. And we support the strikes. Just want to make it very clear that this episode was recorded before the strike started. Right now the request is for writers and actors to not record any new promotional material, but there is no problem with releasing things that were recorded before the strike started. Just want to make that clear. A very good year does not cross picket lines, and neither does James Urbaniak. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, hillbilly demagogues and chess-playing knights and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
And our guest today is just straight up one of the great character actors of his generation, with nearly 200 credits to his name, including, and these are just a few of our favorites, American Splendor, The Fabelmans, Difficult People, The Office, my beloved Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and several excellent Hal Hartley films, including Henry Fool, Faye Grimm, and Ned Rifle. And of course, he voices Dr. Venture on The Venture Brothers, which was just revived for the new original movie, The Venture Brothers Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart, which is available now for digital purchase and is out Tuesday on Blu-ray. Folks, pop the champagne, crank the noisemakers. Here's James Urbaniak. Hi, James.
Hi, Jason. Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for doing this, man. We're really excited to have you. You know, we booked you for the show because I've heard you on many podcasts. You're an outstanding guest. You're very clearly like a serious cinephile, and yes. And you love old timey things. Love old timey things.
All correct.
But it was only after we arranged it and I was putting it into our calendar that I realized we were going to put this episode out so close to the release of this new Venture Brothers movie. So let's start by plugging it. What can fans of the show expect from the Venture Brothers Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart?
First of all, I just want to say I'm so glad that we get to plug a movie like real show business here.
Yes, right?
I will do a film podcast at the drop of a hat with nothing to promote.
Yes.
But it just so of happens course. That I have something to promote, so I come off as very professional,
yes.
Which I like. Well, the old gang gets back together for one last caper. That's one way to describe the film. You know, the series, when the series was canceled, we didn't officially know when we were doing the last season. So Jackson, the creator of the show, was always a little disappointed. He didn't get to sort of finish the series. And then they did work out a deal where they were able to do this feature-length special. So, you know, it is a movie, which kind of ties up a lot of loose ends to a degree and sort of says goodbye in a way that I think the fans are really going to enjoy. But I'm sworn to secrecy. It's a great show, but I can't really say much about it in detail. But I think the fans are going to be very pleased with it. I think it's wonderful.
Yay. That's great. Well, okay. And it's been, correct me if I'm wrong, 5 years since the show ended. So, I mean, as an actor, what was that experience like of you know, stepping back into a role after that long of a break from it?
It's kind of par for the course with that show because the pilot aired 20 years ago, although the show only has 7 seasons. So sometimes there's a couple years that go by between seasons just because they take a long time making the show and then it's animated. So it takes a long time to produce. So I was kind of used to the show not being a part of my life for extended periods of time and then suddenly recording it again. And Dr. Venture is just a sort of somewhat heightened version of my own voice. as you can tell, Jason, I'm a fairly chill guy, but Dr. Venture is a little more persnickety, a bit more of an a-hole than I am in life. Well, in the way I present myself anyway.
Well, that's lovely. All right. Well, now we've done the proper plug.
Yes.
If this was like a real life, if this was like, you know, if you were on Johnny, we'd have a clip or something to play, but we don't have that.
I liked Johnny when Bob Hope would show up, say a few things and then go, I got to go. I got to leave. That always seemed the most powerful showbiz thing where you didn't do panel on a show. You just left. So
didn't have to sit. Yeah.
No, you didn't have to sit and talk about films. No, it's my pleasure. Again, I'll talk about this stuff at the drop of a hat. So
Well, beautiful. All right. Well, so tell us about the year that you chose and why you picked it, because it's kind of an unconventional one.
Well, you described the concept of the show to me, and I immediately thought, well, let me think. I thought, well, 1976, because you've got Network, Taxi Driver, et al. And then you sent me a spreadsheet, which had the years that had been taken.
Yes.
And 76 had been taken. And I thought, okay,
yes,
let me think about this. I thought, well, let's reverse engineer this. Let me think about some of my favorite films, which are basically films that I revisit constantly. And one of my absolute desert island, probably top five, is Sweet Smell of Success. And I thought, well, what year was Sweet Smell? Because I don't think I knew it was the 50s, but I don't think I knew it was 57 off the top of my head. And I checked and it was 57. And I thought, well, let's see what else was going on in 57. And then it turned out there were other films that I'm very, very fond of in that year. And I just thought, well, I could talk about Sweet Smell and these other films. So let's do that. So that's how that worked out.
Okay, well, that is, you might not be surprised to know, a fairly popular method of picking the film year is to say, well, what's the year that this movie was in? That
is there anything else that would work? And then I went through, I found lists. My son helped me. Yep. We were driving in the car. I explained the show to him, and I said, can you just Google movies from 57 and read the titles to me?
Yep. And there we have it.
And then in a very dad-like way, I would go, oh, yes, Raintree County. That's Montgomery Cliff. And, that didn't make the cut, though.
All right. Well, we're gonna get into this top five, which is extremely good. Some real bangers on here. But before we do, as you said, let's see what else is going on in 57. So Mike is gonna walk us through what else was going on in 57. Here's headlines.
1957 was not the international shit show that has been common in this segment.
Yay!
The Korean War was over.
Yeah.
We weren't really wrapped up in Nam yet. You know, the Cold War was happening, but...
The Capitol Mall was thronged with an estimated 750,000. President Eisenhower, reelected by a plurality of over 9 million votes, arrived for swearing-in ceremonies. The oath of office was administered by Chief Justice Warren. And Ike opened his second term with a fervent call for brotherhood in this time of tragic world division.
May the light of freedom, coming to all darkened lands, flame brightly, until at last the darkness is no more.
In January, Kansas kid made good Dwight Eisenhower was sworn in for his second term as U.S. president, and there was no competition about the crowd.
Yeah, there we go. So, James, Mike and I are both from Kansas originally. So,
yes.
Dwight D. Eisenhower, the trip to the Eisenhower house was a standby of our elementary school years. He was sort of one of like four examples of how you could leave Kansas and go on to something else.
In February, the shitty Brits executed Mau Mau freedom fighter Dedan Kamathi, and if that comes as a surprise, you must be a first-time listener, so welcome to the show.
Yeah, that's a little bit of colonialism, even when it's not the war, the war-heavy headlines. Yep.
You know we're going to bring it up.
Celebrations continued well into the night as fireworks ushered in the dawn for a new African state. And Dr. Nkrumah, the Commonwealth's first African Prime Minister, has declared his country's pride in joining the British family of nations.
There is a new African in the world. That new African is ready to fight his own battle and show that, after all, the black man is capable of managing his own affairs.
In March, British colonies Gold Coast and British Togoland became the independent nation of Ghana. So
yay,
good for them.
Yay.
All right.
Yeah.
Corollary. Also in March was the Treaty of Rome, which established the European Economic Community, which would evolve 42 years later into the European Union.
All right. Hooray for that.
Yeah, so there was a lot of foundation setting in 57.
There we go.
In April, IBM sold the first computer that used the Fortran scientific programming language, and I don't know what any of that means, but people who do have assured me it was very important.
Yeah, that sounds significant.
Hooray. It does, doesn't right? it? It's got just that, yeah. that official ring to it. This is back, computers were still like the size of a house, right?
Yeah, and it had to right. be in a giant air-conditioned room. Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Exactly. In July, 15-year-old Paul McCartney met John Lennon when he went to a Corryman show at St. Peter's Church in Woolton. Aww. And we haven't been rid of that happy-go-lucky motherfucker since.
Wow.
I love how all of the stories about the early days of the Beatles are all just like everyone just wanted to hang out with John because John was cool. That's like, that seems to be kind of the instigating factor of that entire band was people just wanted an excuse to hang out with John.
And I That's think, nice. Isn't there a photo from that very day? There's a day where like,
there is
he's performing with him. They're wearing plaid shirts or something. Yeah.
They are on like on like a flatbed behind like a truck. It's an extremely, yeah. it's a charmingly low rent gig.
Yeah, and they have like their them. Teddy Boy pompadours, which was the style.
They sure do.
Before Astrid in Berlin showed them the German arty student haircut. But enough about the Beatles. That's it for a different podcast.
Well, also, their eyes are actually all the way open because marijuana hadn't made it to Woolton yet.
Yes.
There we go.
No gateway.
In July, Raya Ataya took her seat in the National Assembly of Egypt and became the first female parliamentarian. That word, I've been trying yeah. to say it for so long, and I yeah. still can't quite get it. Became the first female parliamentarian in the Arab world.
All right.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear.
In
that.
September, our Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1957, okay. which was a soft start,
mm-hmm.
to be nice about it. Mm-hmm. But it was a start nonetheless. It would be followed up by the Civil Rights Acts of 1960, 64, 65, and 68, Good because Lord. The 57 bill had to be watered down pretty dramatically. But mm-hmm. it was a genuine effort by some people, like Lyndon Johnson worked on it, which I don't think anybody was really... expected him to be so excited about right. it, but that would prefigure some things that would happen later.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. Here, an artist's conception of how the feat was accomplished. A three-stage rocket. Number one, the booster in the class of an intercontinental missile. Its weight estimated at 50 tons. The smaller second stage took over at 5,000 miles an hour and carried on to the highest point reached. 500 miles up, the artificial moon is boosted to a speed counterbalancing the pull of gravity and released. You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
But the most exciting news of 1957 came in October and November when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1 and 2, respectively, Hello. The first satellites ever put into orbit. Sputnik 2 included the first animal ever sent into space, hey. But they had no plans for bringing her back alive. So Man. November 3rd is also the day we say RIP like a good girl if there ever was one.
That's right.
They had no qualms whatsoever with just killing some animals to get some stuff up into space. That's fine.
Oh, dude, there was a lot of experimentation happening in the 1950s that, yeah. you know.
By the way, I've been in Angeleno since 2007, and about a week ago, I went to the infamous Museum of Jurassic Technology for the first time. I don't know. Uh-huh. Are you familiar with this? Whereabouts are you, Mike? Where do you live?
I'm in Portland, Oregon, and I have seen several internet articles about that place, but have not visited in person.
It's a very strange sort of art installation slash sort of museum that's commenting on museums, but it does have a display that touches on the early Soviet space program, and there are portraits of the space dogs, including Laika, so.
Now, when you say nice. When you say portraits, you mean like proper painted like
I don't know how likenesses? Proper they are. They're illustrations. I'm not sure how formal
Aww.
They are, but there's a little tribute to those dogs who went to space for the Russians in one of the rooms.
Aww, that's nice.
Yeah,
that's...
if you've ever Googled Atlas Obscura,
okay.
then that the technology museum has come up in your searches later. We got a couple of new things in 57, including the first flight of the Boeing 707 airliner mm-hmm. and the invention of the laser by Richard Gordon Gould.
Really? Right.
Pew, pew. Yay, lasers.
And rock and roll was also in its infancy, and about 20 years, those two would dovetail quite spectacularly with the laser show.
That's right.
But they weren't even acquaintances in 57 yet, rock and roll and lasers.
Nope. Separate worlds.
A lot of people died, and you've heard of some of them, but our attention in this episode will go to the 800,000 Chinese nationals who were murdered by Mao Zedong's regime between 1949 and 1954 for being class enemies. That is the number he admitted to in 1957. So, of course, many people assume the real number is higher than that. Little reminder all to all the tankies and Red Book bros out there, kill your idols. They were awful people, too.
All right.
Katie Couric was born in 1957. Does that make up for my Mao rant, Jason?
Sure.
Does that make up for my Mao rant? Also, Mario, we complain about the colonial British and stuff all the time. You know, I feel like, you know, we got to give out equal equal raspberries, right?
Sure, sure.
Also, Mario Van Peebles, Steve Harvey, Frank Miller was born in 1957.
Good.
LeVar Burton, who somehow seems much younger than Frank Miller. I don't know how to explain that. How it works in my head.
Disposition, maybe.
It's hair and general energy, yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Vanna White, the professionally dead Osama bin Laden, and Qasem Soleimani were both born in 57. Mm-hmm. Amanda Plummer, Paul Reiser, Joaquin Guzman, a.k.a. El Chapo.
All right.
Africa Bambaataa, Jan Hooks. If I said Joaquin Guzman, everybody would be trying to figure out what actor, like what movie he was in.
Right.
But it was the drug dealer, right? Yes. We all know Al Chapo.
Yes.
The only person who can be properly called a thespian, Mr. Daniel Day-Lewis.
I don't think
anybody else has really earned the title. I think he's the one.
I heartily agree.
There we go.
Sid Vicious porn star Peter North, who only did one gay scene as far as I know, but looked like he really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Judge Reinhold, Susie Sue, who was English and not Native American.
All right.
The Queen, Frances McDormand. The King, John Turturro. Steve Buscemi, Melanie Griffith.
All right, that's going to be
born in 57.
Yeah, that's going to be the Dream Blunt rotation there. Frances McDormand, John Turturro, Steve Buscemi, and Melanie Griffith.
Quite a year for actors and that one thespian.
Yeah. Yes.
The first three have definitely smoked a joint together. I don't see how it's possible that they haven't. Dennis Leary, professional wrestler Bret Hart, Kelly McGillis, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan, Mr. Cameron Crowe, Chinese artist Ai Weiwei, Gloria Estefan, Hans Zimmer, Ethan Cohen, Nick Cave, who's a better writer than a musician, if you ask me, hot take.
Okay.
Fran Drescher, Bernie Mac, RIP, Ray Romano, and finally, friend of the show, Mr. Spike Lee, one of the all-time greats, born in 57.
All right.
What do you think of the idea of the Dodgers moving to Los Angeles?
I don't like the idea.
How about the Dodgers moving to Queens?
I don't like that idea either.
Well, where would you rather see them if you had to choose between the two?
I'd rather see them right here in Brooklyn.
In sports news, Walter O'Malley, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, agreed to move the team from the borough to Los Angeles, and frankly, I'm not over it. Who can care about the snooker lines with the Dodgers in California? That's headlines.
An outright betrayal to the city of New York and the borough of Brooklyn. How dare he? All right, James Urbaniak, you ready to do a top five?
Let's do it.
All right, so here we go. What is the first film? We tipped the hand there, the instigator of the 1957
the instigator.
List.
The instigator is Sweet Smell of Success, directed by Alexander McKendrick.
Burt Lancaster as J.J. Hunsaker, world-famed columnist whose gossip is gospel to 60 million readers. Tony Curtis as Sidney Falco, the kid who had ideas about taking over.
But we happen to know I'm your star pupil, because I reflect back to you your own talent.
I'd hate to take a bite of you. You're a cookie full of arsenic.
Don't turn your back on him. You might find a knife in it. This is their story, and that of the big shots and big names who worship the sweet smell of success.
Starring Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis.
A fucking terrifying Burt Lancaster. Like a
terrifying.
Oh my God.
Terrifying in a different way because,
yes,
as we all know, he's very physically imposing and he would often play these sort of tough guys who always had a sort of introspective quality to them. But in this case, he's playing a bespectacled newspaper columnist who's modeled on Walter Winchell. So, but he's so in this, he's more of a sort of psychological and cultural terrorist.
Yes.
than a bruiser. Than, although you always get the feeling that Burt Lancaster's version of Walter Winchell could lay some hurt on you if he wanted to.
Yes.
But it's all about this 100%. Wonderful, but what he does in the movie is it's all about this sort of inner rage and this mm-hmm. very frightening sort of management of his energy, and it's a great performance. And Tony Curtis is really great in the movie too.
I mean, was Tony Curtis ever better in a movie than he was in this movie?
I don't know. It's certainly one of his best ones. I mean, he's very funny and
desperate and sleazy. And
no, I meant in Some Like It Hot, you know, which is like around the same era. But yeah, he's really you really get the character's emotional trajectory in this in a very clear way. You know, for those who don't know, Tony Curtis plays a down and out press agent. Burt Lancaster is what they used to call a Broadway columnist. He's an entertainment journalist. And back in this era, entertainment journalists were very big. It's the equivalent of TMZ or, you know, what the old Entertainment Tonight show. And so you'd want to get the PR guys would want their clients mentioned. Ed Sullivan famously had been one of these Broadway columnists before his TV show. And Walter Winchell was one of the most famous and most notorious. He was also known as, kind of a right-wing.
A real son of a bitch.
Yeah, a real son of a bitch. And while it's not literally Winchell, and it's not even like, that's just sort of the jumping off point. And it's based on a novelette that Ernst Lehman, the great screenwriter, wrote that was based on when he worked for one of these guys, another one, not Winchell.
Right.
But I think these guys all had certain qualities in common. So, so it's about Tony Curtis's press agent, Sidney Falco, trying to play the angles and do whatever he can do to get into Lancaster's, to get his clients into Lancaster's column. Lancaster has one of the great movie names. His columnist name is J.J. Hunsecker.
It just it rolls right off the tongue.
It rolls right off the tongue, which I think the Coen brothers are obviously referencing with the Hunsecker proxy, you know.
Oh, definitely. Oh, God, yes.
And basically, Lancaster asks Tony to do dirty things to smear this guy who's wants to marry Burt Lancaster's character's sister, and it's all about the thing I love about the movie is it's extremely New York. It's shot in there are location shots outside of New York, which is somewhat rare in that period and really delightful to see. And then the other thing is everyone is playing everybody else. So even people, so characters who look like they're being played, there's a reveal that they're actually playing the person playing them. It's just.
And the relationship, but especially between Sidney Falco and J.J. Hunsinker is so complicated and is such a, I mean, the sort of psychological depths of what's happening between them, almost borderline homoeroticism that's in place there. Like, it's a really thorny, complicated relationship.
Yeah, and then J.J. Hunsecker is very overprotective of his sister, his, like, kid's sister.
I would say creepily overprotective.
Oh, creepily. No, it's kind of like the Scarface thing where there's this sort of suggestion of an incestuous thing that I can't have you, therefore no one can have you, you know, that sort of...
Right.
Where it seems to be psychologically. And then meanwhile, Lehman wrote the book and the original screenplay. And then famously Clifford Odets, speaking of the Coen brothers again, Barton Fink himself, came in and did another draft. And I don't know who wrote what, but it's just full of this legendary, wonderful sort of crackling New York dialogue. That's very heightened and not really the way people talk, but it just rings true, you know.
It's the way you want them to have talked.
Totally.
It's like the way you imagine them talking.
But there's lines like, you're a cookie full of arsenic. I'd hate to take a bite out of you. And they're so quotable.
Ah, oh, that's great. It's a great movie. All right, let's take a look at the next movie on your top five list. Another sort of scorching media satire.
It is.
Brilliant screenplay. What's the next movie on your list, James?
The next movie is The Face in the Crowd, directed by Elia Kazan.
Oh, Lonesome Rhodes. Look out for him. He's mean. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Andy Griffith, another sensational newcomer from Elia Kazan, who brought you Marlon Brando and James Dean and Carol Baker.
Starring Andy Griffith, like you've never seen him before.
that's what I think is nuts for like a contemporary audience, for a modern viewer who does not know this film to go see it. Like if you only know him as Andy Taylor,
or if
you only know him as Matlock, like it is a mind blowing performance.
It is mind. And the thing is, apparently, I believe this was his first film. I think.
Yeah. I believe you're right.
And I know he had done like Broadway. He was in a Broadway comedy called No Time for Sergeants, which became a movie. Mm-hmm. I think he was in the play, but I guess he had performed on stage. But the thing is, his introduction to audiences, he's playing this kind of shit-kicking good old boy who is just kind of a drifter and a drinker who gets into scrapes and screws around he's in jail just on some like drunken disorderly charge for like a couple days. And the great Patricia Neal, one of my favorite actors from this period.
Wonderful.
Comes in and she works for a local radio station and she's doing a radio show. I think that she calls Faces in the Crowd or something. And she's just going to get some local color. She's going to get talk to the men at the prison and we'll learn a little bit about them, you know.
Yeah.
And Andy Griffith, the character is not a performer, but he just turns it on when she
just lights right up.
Lights right up. Play. He has a guitar. He sings some songs. He's got. He knows how to turn on the charm and the bullshit, basically. And he becomes sort of a beloved they're like, the radio station realizes this guy's money in the bank, and he grows from being a local figure to a sort of national figure and to like a state figure to then like a national figure, where he ends up like becoming getting into politics and becoming kind of a kingmaker, a tastemaker. I must say, when Mr. Trump became president, many people brought up this movie. The movie is also a very entertaining sort of satire on media hype and culture in a way that hasn't really dated at all. It's not as satirical as Network in the way it's skewed, but it's parallel to Network in its concerns and a kind of timeless dissection of sort of media sickness.
Yeah.
That's still totally relevant.
Idea that like that we can seize on someone for, you know, for seeming to have an authenticity, for a sense of this is a voice of the common man, and then of course up to something much more devious than that. The thing that always breaks my heart about this movie, and I don't want to spoil it, but suffice it to say that there is an unmasking at the end of the movie, and you know, when these comparisons were being drawn to Mr. Trump, a lot of people were saying, well, he's going to have his, you know, his unmasking. And I really get a sense after, you know, this many years of this, that I don't think the followers would care much. I don't think if they heard the speech that he is overheard giving at the end of this film, I don't think he would lose one vote.
Well, and call me crazy, but Trump is unmasked. We all know what he is.
Mm-hmm.
And his fans like his depravity and what a pig he is. That's what they like about him.
Yes.
But Andy Griffith's character is existing in Eisenhower's 1957 America.
Right.
So it's all about him projecting homespun wisdom. He gets a little naughty sometimes, but in a playful way that the housewives like, you know.
Yes.
He starts out like being it's like a daytime show. So his listeners are all women, and then he knows how to curry favor with them, you know. Your husbands don't appreciate you when you're cleaning the stove, you know. But Kazan directed it, who's obviously great with actors, but it is extraordinary how truly great. It's not extraordinary how great he is, because Andy Griffith was really talented. It's just that the Andy Griffith we know, like you say, from the show and from the TV shows, is this gentle soul. But his energy in this is very early Billy Bob Thornton.
Yes, very much so. And you know who else?
Yeah.
You know who else is great early in his career? Walter Matthau.
Matthau has a really nice supporting role as like a writer for the radio station.
The striking thing about Walter Matthau is no matter how early you catch him in his career, he still looks like 46 years old minimum. Like never actually looked young.
Now, yes, he has the gift of eternal middle age, that guy. I love Matthew. Matthew's great. And Patricia Neal is truly one of the greats. She's all her moments are so, she just has such emotional clarity. And she has this wonderful face and these incredibly expressive eyes. And you really see, she's a great film actor because you really see what's going on in her head and her heart at any given moment. And of course, Kazan is all about emotional clarity, and it just feels like a director with actors who are all on the same page.
Yeah. One of the greats. All right. Moving on from a sort of quintessential American film of the 1950s to perhaps the quintessential 1950s foreign film.
Totally.
James, what is the third film on your top five?
The third film is The Seventh Seal by the master Ingmar Bergman. Death plays chess.
Fellow Gen Xers out there, this is the one they're referencing in the second and third Bill and Ted movies.
Exactly. And many other parodies.
So many Family Guy episodes.
But I got to say, you watch it and those scenes hold up. They withstand the years of parody. I was looking at 1957. I saw that this was on the list. And same year, it's quite a year for Mr. Bergman, Wild Strawberries, which I'm equally fond of. But I think it's just, I had actually seen like Seven Seal a couple times in the last year. It was on Criterion. And then one day I came out of the bedroom and it was on. My wife was watching it. It was like Seven Seal. And it wasn't a death scene. It was another scene, but I recognized it. And I was like, ah, yeah, it's great. But I love Seven Seal. It's an incredible, I love Wild Strawberries, but I just kind of chose this because it's so damned iconic.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I think what's great about it is iconic. There's so many images that have just sort of seared themselves onto, you know, the collective cinematic subconscious, if I may wax highfalutin for a moment. And yet it is not, so many of those movies that are the sort of canonical, especially foreign films of that era, you know, have this reputation as being, you know, sort of difficult movies and you got to make a whole, you know, it's really got to psych yourself out and sit down and do your homework when you watch them. And what to me is remarkable about The Seventh Seal is that it's for a movie that's a Swedish, you know, meditation on death and faith. It's a really easy watch. It's a breezy 96 minutes.
I agree with you.
It's, you know, it's got fart jokes in it. It's it's not a tough movie. It's actually pretty easy to sort of settle into. I have found in the past and again on this rewatch.
I agree with you. And there's always Bergman, when he wants to be funny, is really funny.
Yeah, he is.
Three of the main characters are a little troupe of vaudevillian actors, you know.
And that always gets a laugh or two.
And there's a whole comedy subplot with one of them is having an affair with like this local, blacksmith's wife. And that's all played very comedically. It's just about the whole damn thing. I mean, it's life and death, you know, it's set during the Middle Ages. I think it's sort of historically fudging timelines and things.
Oh, totally.
But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter if the Crusades actually happened at a different time, you know. You've got this knight who was in the Crusades and and you've got the Black Plague happening, and it's like a ready-made metaphor when death is right in front of you and people are dying right next to you from this plague. That's a very usable ready-made metaphor for the fact that we're all walking that line.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all going to end up in the, you know, dead in the field, as it were, at some point. It's just this sort of, I don't know, they do a little traveling in the movie. It's kind of a medieval picaresque pageant. Yeah.
Yes. An outdoor chamber piece somehow. Yeah.
And then like Bergman's father, you know, was apparently a very strict, you know, minister. And so there's a lot of that in there of him dealing with this personal stuff. Faith, there are these, you know, flagellating Christians who come through at one point. A young woman is going to be burned at the stake for witchcraft and speaking to the devil. And frankly, if I may be permitted a comparison, it's a little like The Northman.
hey, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, just because that movie says, well, it's set in this time of the Vikings, and we're just going to give their beliefs credit. So we're going to say this is a place where you believe in gods on horses flying through the sky, you know?
Yeah.
And the movie just says this is the reality of these people. And that's what Seven Seal does. It's just this is the belief system here. Bergman isn't saying, well, this is obviously a very dated belief system. He's just kind of presenting it, like draw your own conclusions. And then there are elements to that resonate out of that that are timeless.
But the questions that he's asking a lot of times, because this is the thing that really just broke my fucking brain about this movie the first time I saw it. And I had to watch it sort of several times over the next year or so to figure out how to understand it, because 57 is also the era of existentialism and Sartre and, you know, Camus and sort of the post-World War II, the like trying to find a reason not to be a nihilist, trying to find a reason to think that there's any sort of hope or future in humanity now that we've created this bomb and we've industrialized war. And so it's a very heavy period philosophically, whether or not you're a philosopher.
Oh,
so
like there, yes.
The questions that are being asked, I think, are actually contemporaneous to Bergman and to what they're doing. And the fact that somehow makes sense in a medieval storyline with medieval characters, that's the thing that I still don't really understand how he even conceived of that, let alone pulled it off.
But that's the only way that I love historical dramas and I love things that are set in the past, you know. But the only way they're going to resonate is if you find the modern connection to those stories, you know. Why are you telling a story set in this time? And so, of course, they're going to be about the times that they were created in. And that's a dynamic that makes those stories pop when they really work.
Let's continue on down the bleak path then with another rather dark picture. James, what's the number four film on your list?
The next movie is Canal.
Żaden nawet nie pierdnął w marszu, bo inaczej nas Niemcy wysiekły.
Directed by Andrzej Wajda, I believe is the correct way you say that.
You know what? You say it with your full, with your whole chest. Like, I believe that's how it's said, even if that's not correct. It was a confident pronunciation.
I had to look up. I went to YouTube because I wanted to see how an English speaker pronounced Andrzej Wajda's name, and I found a clip of Jane Fonda introducing him when he got his honorary Oscars at the Academy Awards, like in the 90s. And she says, with great clarity, Andrzej Wajda, like she practiced it. Because I'm a dumb American. I'm like, Wajda, you know. Vida. You don't pronounce the J is silent. And I am a Polish extraction. Urbaniak is Polish. My grandfather was an immigrant from the old country, but I didn't know how to say Vida. But of course, Urbaniak is just an arbitrary American pronunciation of a Polish name. So I don't know how they said it there, you know. But here's what happened. I told you earlier that I was driving with my son, who's 17, and I said, hey, I got to do this podcast. It's about movies from 57. Can you Google movies from 57? Just read the titles to me. So he's going along doing that. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting, you know. And then at one point, I'm like, go lower on the list. Like, not like the top 20 or, you know, let's get, some of these lists are very long. And then it's basically like a list of everything. And it's no reflection on the quality of the movie, but this was sort of further down the list. And he said, Canal. And then he went like, my Polish-American son went, Andrzej Wajda, you know. And I was like, oh. So then I'm like, let me look up Canal. And it's on Criterion. And I'm like, oh, great. I'm gonna watch this. And within the first 5 minutes, I'm like, this is fucking amazing.
Like, that movie gets you right.
Oh my
God.
It opens with this incredible tracking shot. It's about the Warsaw Uprising during World War II, which didn't work out, by the way. It's like, you know, but it's the resistance. And there's this incredible opening sequence where they're just tracking these members of the resistance through like this completely battle-scarred terrain. And
think Soy Cuba.
Yeah.
I mean, like it's super Russian.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. Equally sort of stunning visually. Although Soy Cuba kind of leads with its political beliefs, and this more sort of just presents things in a way that I think is more satisfying dramatically.
I was really just talking about the blocking and the camera work. I mean, it's so awesome.
Yeah, and there's a moving camera, and it's this really long tracking shot. And meanwhile, the terrain is just, they've recreated wartime Warsaw, and there's like rubble, buildings that have, you know, been blown up, and then just surreal stuff. Like there's a piano on the street because it was in a house that doesn't exist anymore.
And it works.
And there's papers all over the street from, you know, somewhere. It's just, and it just really grabs you. And then the movie is about these, this ragtag group of Polish resistors fighting the Nazis. It's a combination of army people and civilians, including a couple of great women characters. And it's just the canal of the title is the sewer. The bulk of the movie, they go underground and they're in war and they're literally in the shit. It's not metaphorical. They're literally in the shit, in the sewer. And frankly, it's really hard to take because it's extremely intense.
It's the toughest movie kiss I've ever seen in my life. When those two people have been crawling through shit for an
hour. There are two lovers.
And then he tries to kiss her. And I was just like, oh, come on, bro. Like, not with my last breath. Yes. Oh, my God.
Because meanwhile, like, they're running out of oxygen down there because they're stirring up the sewage. The fumes are rising. And it's just, it's a hard environment to be in. But Vida is a great director, and you've got all this stuff going on. You've got dimension and depth of character. You have the dynamics within the group. You have the infighting, you know, within the group. You're getting ideas of what these people's lives were like outside. Meanwhile, the bulk of the film is in this completely contained environment, and he just keeps finding these really dramatic and compelling and visually exciting ways to stage a bunch of people walking through a fucking sewer, you know, for an hour. It just really astonished me. And I thought, well, let's put that on the list.
Yeah.
But it's highly recommended, but not an easy watch.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the point.
This has a what's in the box level bad news ending. I mean, like, I don't know how else to describe it. Like, the end of this movie is so, if you don't like movies with happy endings, if you think it takes balls to make a movie that doesn't have a happy ending, whoo boy, is Canal for you.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we're going to wrap up our walk through the international cinema of 57, and we're going to wrap up your top five. James, what is the last film on your list for 57?
The last one is Knights of Cabiria by Federico Fellini, which is just great.
Le notti di Cabiria, 188 a quarta. Silenzio! Azione! Questa è Cabiria. Una piccola donna sola e indifesa che vive nel male senza perdere la speranza del bene.
I was wondering, there were a few other movies I was wondering about. I know we'll talk about other movies from the period. But I thought, oh, I really do love this one. And this movie, not to give it away, for those who haven't seen it, this movie also ends as with sort of a downer, and then there's a little bit of possible positivity at the end. But this is the last shot of this movie is my favorite last shot of any film.
Wow.
Like the last the last minute of the movie is like my absolute favorite. It just completely gets me. With the great Julieta Messina acting that moment.
She's an astonishing.
She's so good.
I want to say a couple of months into lockdown, Criterion had put out this essential Fellini box, and I really went about sort of filling some of those blind spots.
Yeah.
Saw this and a couple of the others for the first time. And you cannot overstate what a magnetic, charismatic, brilliant performer she is.
Funny. Like,
she's just, oh God.
Really funny.
She makes you laugh. She breaks your heart. She's incredible.
She totally does. Yeah. She's great. She's the perfect actor for him, really. You know, it's just one of those great, I mean, I know there were a couple at one point, or I don't know for how long, but it really is up there with like Scorsese, De Niro, or, you know, it's just one of those great collabs where they really get each other. It's great. Yeah. And of course it was, as we know, it was remade as a rather more lighthearted musical comedy called Sweet Charity.
Softened some of the edges a bit.
Softened some of the edges.
The work she does. And yes.
But she, she is a, she's kind of a, she's a streetwalker. She's a low level sex worker in 1950s Italy, in Rome, I guess. And it's just sort of about her, where life takes her.
looking for love in all the wrong places.
One night a famous movie star just sees her on the street and actually doesn't hire her for sex, just takes her to hang out with him because he's like having love troubles and just wants someone to hang out with. And she goes through all these experiences, and she's she has a sort of indefatigable hope, because her life is not a great life, but she believes in the possibility of, you know, a future, getting married. And then I don't know how spoilerish you get on the show. I mean, I know it is a very famous movie.
You can spoil. It's okay.
But at the end, she has all these adventures, and eventually, and in a very Fellini-esque way, since he did direct the movie, you know, these very colorful characters and situations in Rome, which have so much life to them. The way that Sweet Smell has such a sense of the life of New York City, this really has a sense of the life of Rome. And she meets this guy. She goes to a performance by like a hypnotist, and he does this hypnotism, and under the spell, she sort of talks about the life that she imagines, you know, which is more peaceful and domesticated. And then this guy is sort of taken with her and talks to her, and they start going out, and she's extremely wary of this guy, very tentative. But then eventually they seem to be really fond of each other, and they're falling in love, and he wants to marry her. And then there's this really, if you haven't seen it and you don't want to spoil it, just skip ahead a minute on the podcast. But anyway, he ends up fucking her over. And at the end, like, he runs away from her and steals money from her. And she's as low as she's ever been. And she walks back from this betrayal, this brutalization that she's gone through with this guy. And she goes back she sold her house. She has to find somewhere else to live. She's just walking through the streets, and these young people are playing music, and they're just walking through the streets. I'm going to start to tear up. This kills me.
Yeah.
And a young person turns to her and says, "Buenas, Sarah. Good evening." And she, you can see she's been crying, and then just a hint of a smile and that beautiful face that we've loved through the whole movie pops up. And we know that she knows there's still hope and it's not over. And she's not going to throw herself into the water. You know, she's going to keep going and trying. And it's so simple, but so powerful and just so great. And I really is like, it's my favorite ending of a movie.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. And you know, and also it's that specific sort of wonderful shock of seeing a movie from an era where we feel like everything has the Hollywood happily ever after ending.
Yeah.
And so it's a genuine shock when she is betrayed by him. But then to find that little note of bittersweet lift and to play it out on that is just, it's,
oh, it's over. And then Nina Rota's score kicks in and it's so great. Yes. Another one of the all time great composer director collaborators is up there with Spielberg and Williams. It's just so perfect. And that they're playing this very, you know, Nina Rota Fellini music, the, you know, diegetically, you know, at the end of the movie. But yeah, but the whole thing is just a masterpiece. And it just has so much color, and it's a black and white movie, but it you know what I mean? It has so much environmental color and character in it. And it's one of the all-time great movie performances by her.
Yeah, agreed. All right. Well, James, thank you so much. That is an excellent top five.
I was impressed when I realized these all came out in 57.
Yeah, there's a nice group of films, some highs, some lows, but all beautifully crafted. All right, let's find out what films were winning trophies and making money. Here's Mike with awards and box office. Sell out with me, oh yeah, sell out
with me tonight. The record company's only getting my lots of money. This will be no surprise. Best picture, best director to David Lean, and best actor to Alec Guinness for Bridge on the River Kwai. Wait, you mean he was in a movie before Star Wars?
Yeah. He did.
Use the bridge, Luke.
By the way, that, not surprisingly, that was a big contender from my list.
Yeah, it's a
great movie. I love Guinness as one of my absolute top heroes, and I love David Lean. But it just didn't quite make this list for some reason. I think Canal bumped it out. I was like, I haven't seen Canal before, and it's so. And now another World War II movie, very different, equally great. But I just I think Canal got it because it was new to me, and there was something very exciting about that to me. Where I was like, oh, but we all know. And also, I was like, I want to get the word out. We all know Bridge.
Yes,
you know?
yes. Yeah, I have a hot take here. That David Lean, good director. Knew how to put a picture together.
And I'll say that's a rare case where a Oscar's best picture is actually a great movie.
Yes. We always like when that happens.
Oddly deserving of that dubious title. Especially in the 50s.
Yeah, no kidding.
Best actress went to Joanne Woodward for The Three Faces of Eve.
I love that.
Ooh. Yes. Well, she's brilliant. I haven't seen that since like the 1980s, but she's a great actor.
Yeah, I'm fine with whatever they want to give Joanne Woodward Oscars for.
Love Joanne Woodward.
Best supporting actor went to Red Buttons. I did not know Red Buttons was an Oscar winner.
Yes.
Yeah.
And best supporting actress went to Miyoshi Umeki for Sayonara.
I have not seen Sayonara. Have you seen this one, James?
Is Brando in that? Is that like a World War II story?
He is indeed. Yep.
I may have, but it's been a long time, and I don't really remember anything about it.
Best foreign language film... well-deserved Knights of Cabiria.
Yay! Oscar winner Knights of Cabiria. Nice.
Some other significant award winners. The Golden Globe for Best Picture and Best Actress, Comedy or Musical. Ty, Kay Kendall, and Taina Elg. Elg?
That sounds right.
Are they? And they're both in, they're both in the same movie?
Yes. It was a tie win to two actresses in the same movie, which was Les Girls.
Les Girls. Right.
Which I have not seen.
I wasn't sure I was reading that correctly, but
no, that's, yeah.
Golden Globe for Best Actor in a Comedy or Musical went to Frank Sinatra for Pal Joey.
Yeah, baby.
There's a kangaroo in that one, right?
Is there?
No, definitely not.
I've never seen Pal Joey.
I have not either.
Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress went to Elsa Lanchester for Witness for the Prosecution.
Ah, yes, a comic turn as Charles Lawton's nurse.
Mm.
That's fine. She's super. Did she win for Bride of Frankenstein? Probably
she
not.
She did not.
Yeah, so they gave it to her for Bride of Frankenstein. They realized that was
fine.
A mistake.
That was her makeup, Golden Globe.
That's one of those where, yeah, they gave it for her lifelong, anyway.
Yes, this was her scent of a woman.
Exactly, 100%.
Box office top 10. We've heard a couple of these movies in the episode so far.
Yeah, yeah.
Number 10 was Don't Go Near the Water, which sounds like a really fucking cool horror movie, but was actually a comedy with Glenn Ford about the Navy because a lot of people had been in that in the previous generation.
Big era for the service comedy, if I recall correctly. James, have you seen Don't Go Near the Water?
I've never even heard of Don't Go Near the Water.
Yeah, me neither.
I am a fan, but I have seen many other films of the era. Mr. Roberts, Operation Madball. Yep. To name a couple of service World War II comedies. The lighter side of World War II.
the wacky side of the war against the Nazis.
I enjoy that genre.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Number 9 was Gunfight at the OK Corral by John Sturges.
Pretty fucking good.
Ah, good, solid, sturdy Sturges Western. I like.
Number 8 was Pal Joey, so y'all haven't seen it, but somebody did.
They did indeed.
Number 7 was a tie between Island in the Sun and A Farewell to Arms.
Okay. I haven't seen those.
Huh? Number 6, Montgomery Clift and Elizabeth Taylor in Raintree County.
Which James has watched 25 minutes of. Yep.
I'll revisit. Because I am a completist when it comes to Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift. So
yes,
I would be remiss, as they say, if I didn't watch all 3 hours of Raintree County.
Oh God! All right,
number 5, very 1957, Old Yeller, bro.
Oh,
Old Yeller was
Old
number
Yeller.
5 for the year.
Old Yeller. Wow. That's a Disney live action. Am I correct?
I believe so.
It was officially Disney. It traumatized a generation with the big dog. Oh, spoiler alert, upcoming, but big dog death at the end of that movie.
No, I know. That's another one that I've known my whole life but never actually seen.
Ah, yeah. They showed that to us. They rolled in the cart with the VHS deck on it and showed us that in school when I was in like second grade. It was not well received.
Then made us read it in like fourth grade. You know, the only way to make the ending of that book worse is to give you a picture of a specific dog to focus on for an hour and a half before it dies.
All right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can let. Yeah, Old Yeller can fade away.
Yep.
Number 4 was Search for Paradise, which is a Cinerama flick.
So none of us have seen that because you don't watch those at home.
Number 3 was Sayonara, as we mentioned before. Number 2 was Peyton Place.
Peyton Place.
Mike Robson's Peyton Place, the paperback sensation that rocked the nation in the 1950s.
Yes.
I've not seen Peyton Place.
I've never seen the movie. Yeah, I know it was one of those saucy novels, one of those sexy novels that become popular.
It was.
And then a movie, but I've never seen it.
And number 1 for 1957, Bridge on the River Kwai.
People went. Boom. They came out whistling the song. It was a radio hit, James. It was a big seller. It was a gold record, the theme from the Bridge on the River Kwai. It was a sensation. All right. You ready to do a lightning round, sir?
Okay, yeah.
All right, here's how we do. Mike's going to put 5 minutes on the clock. I'm going to rapid fire you through a bunch more 1957 movies. If you have something to say about it, say it. If you don't or you haven't seen it, you can pass. Let's see what we can do. Mike, you ready?
Now, these are titles that have not been mentioned yet?
These have not been mentioned as of yet.
All right. Let's try.
Here we go. Sidney Lumet's film debut, 12 Angry Men.
I've seen it, fond of it. Good turn by the great John Fiedler with the high voice. as
nice. One of the nice pull.
Good
little
pull.
Guy who talks like
good
this. Pull. Yes.
Nice pull. Most folks mention Fonda. You went for him. Congratulations.
I always Fiedler over Fonda every time. When James Urbaniak's on the podcast.
That's right. 310 to Yuma.
310 to Yuma. Yeah, I saw that a couple years ago when I was actually writing a Western with my writing partner. And I'd never nice. Seen it. And it's I thought it was really good. I enjoyed 310 to Yuma, the original. I haven't seen the remake.
Yes.
I have not seen the remake.
Solid. Leo McCarey's An Affair to Remember.
This is funny. This is one that I've never seen and have always been meaning to get around to. What's the, is it You've Got Mail? What's the Nora Ephron?
Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah, Sleepless in Seattle. Thank you. Which I saw, also didn't see it at the time and saw that like for the first time a couple years ago and An Affair to Remember. Ah. So such a prominent thing in that movie. I thought, I should watch that. But I haven't yet.
Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory.
Yes. I watched Paths of Glory again like 3 months ago. Great. Yeah. Really holds up.
The Cranes Are Flying was released in 1957.
Now, is this a film of foreign extraction?
It is indeed. It is indeed. And I'm going to mangle the name. Mikhail Kolotsikov.
A Russian film.
Yes.
I do not know The Cranes Are Flying, but that's a very Russian title.
It's sad.
Yeah.
It is indeed.
Did they go into a sewer? Did the cranes go in a sewer?
Douglas Sirk had two pictures in 1957.
Killer.
Written on the Wind and Love Interlude.
It. Yes, Written on the Wind. I've seen Written on the Wind. Now, wait, I can't always remember. His titles always sound alike.
They do.
Is Written on the Wind the one with Dorothy Malone and Robert Stack?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Oh, that's a great one. Really yes. Classic, heightened, Sirkian, Technicolor soap opera stuff. I don't believe I've seen the other film that you mentioned.
Gregory Peck, Lauren Bacall, and Vincent Minnelli's Designing Woman.
Interesting. That sounds like it would appeal to me, but I haven't seen it.
Stanley Donen had two pictures out this year, Funny Face and Kiss Them for Me.
Funny Face I've certainly seen, and I enjoy Audrey Hepburn in that. Right, Audrey Hepburn?
Yep.
I haven't seen the other one.
Yeah, that's fun. A lot of these ones with the two up, it's like, well, we remember one of those. Hepburn and Tracy starred in The Desk Set in 1957.
Desk Set is a fine Hepburn and Tracy movie. It's not one of the best, but it's set in an office, and it has, speaking of the early computer technology, there's some early computer technology stuff in that, which is very enjoyable. And it's a sort of Mad Men-esque environment where there is like some big reel-to-reel computer with a bunch of lights on the walls, like a spaceship. And I enjoy that element to it.
Anytime that comes in. Doris Day in The Pajama Game.
I know I've seen The Pajama Game. Is Tony Randall in that one? I know it's Rock Hudson.
Sorry. You know what Tony Randall is in? Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, which also came out in 1957.
Oh, my God, where he does a very big turn.
Yeah.
He has some moments in that where he makes Jim Carrey look like a master of underplay. Tony Randall's another hero. I love Tony Randall. I think Tony Randall's one of those guys who's a great actor, but his thing is comedy, like Gene Wilder.
Yeah.
The default is he's comedic, but he's actually a really great actor from the ground up. And I love it.
Agreed. The Incredible Shrinking Man was released in 1957.
I saw that when I was a kid, like in the 70s. And I've always remembered the last line where he's narrating and he goes, "To God, there is no zero." And for some reason, that line has lived in my head for like 50 years. And my hand to God, recently I was driving down the street and for some reason I was like, "To God, there is no zero." It just popped up again. And I swear I haven't seen that movie since I saw it on TV in like 1976. So
that makes sense.
But again,
and finally,
maybe that's my favorite ending. Maybe I'm wrong about Kabiri.
And finally, I know you recently did a wonderful appearance on Blank Check talking about Buster Keaton. Have you seen Donald O'Connor in 1957's The Buster Keaton Story?
No, and I forgot about this. Donald O'Connor as Buster Keaton. I can see that working. I mean, I can see Donald O'Connor is very talented. And
he was very good in a really terrible movie.
And he's, as we know from, you know, as we know from the other movies, from Singing in the Rain, he's an incredible physical performer, dancer. So I could see him really getting what was special about Keaton. But I haven't seen it, but I would like to. And I believe you that it's not a good movie. But just to see what Donald O'Connor does with Buster would be interesting.
Yes, they do restage the jumping into the lady's stomach gag from Sherlock Jr. in it in a pretty entertaining way.
That's one of the great what the fuck moments in all of cinema.
Yes, it is. All right, I don't want to go out with one that you didn't see. So, James, we had two Elvis movies in 1957. Have you seen Loving You or Jailhouse Rock?
Jailhouse Rock, let me tell you, I watched Jailhouse Rock for the first time because that was on my maybe list, and it almost made the list. And then fucking Canal bumped it off, and I thought, oh, don't do that. Canal's so depressing, and you know, let's have some light. We got Seven Seal, Jailhouse Rock. I thought that would be great, but I...
Yeah.
Here's the thing. It's not a great movie, but I really enjoyed it. And it also parallels A Face in the Crowd. I didn't realize it was a showbiz cautionary tale. I thought the whole thing took place in the jail. He gets out of the jail like 20 minutes into the movie.
Yes.
It's just about his rise as a singer.
Who occasionally sings about life in the jail.
Yeah, it's sort of facing the crowds, you know, slightly, I don't want to say dumber, but maybe less, less interesting cousin. Let's put it that way.
There we go.
Elvis is
great. All right.
Elvis is Elvis, and he's delightful to watch in the movie.
Yes, yes, agreed. All right, fantastic lightning round. Thank you, James. You did very well. And now we're going to throw it to our friend W. Axel Foley for a quick PSA.
Head on over to your favorite podcasting app. Give us a star, a rate, a review. Give us a written review and tell us that you love us, because that's what lets people know that we're here.
All right, James, where can people follow you on the social media?
I'm at James Urbaniak on Twitter and the newly minted Blue Sky, same handle. And that's about it. Keep you informed of all the James Urbaniak news.
All of the news, all of the trivia, exactly. all of the recipes.
I do chime in about movies now and then on the Twitter.
Yes, yes. On frequent occasion. I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Twitter and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show. Mike, where can people follow you?
I am at BrainwashedLib on Twitter.
And of course, we're also on Substack, a very good year.substack.com, where paid subscribers get bonus episodes, bonus writing, and much more. Mike, before we go, sir, what is your favorite movie of the year of our Lord 1957?
I feel like I've picked a Kurosawa movie in the 50s year before, so it might not be much of a surprise, but Throne of Blood came out in 57, and it's Kurosawa's Macbeth, and like... Fuck me, man. That movie's amazing. I thought it was...
Also on my maybe list.
I thought it was sort of like the harshest, craziest, you know, hardest movie that came out in that year until I watched fucking Canal. Turns out it is definitely got bumped down on that list by Canal. But Throne of Blood is great. You know, it is Macbeth, and it's sort of recognizably Macbeth if you know the story. But it's, you know, Bailey, we've talked about this before. I love Japanese movies where they like take Western, you know, like I mentioned a Japanese vampire movie where they sort of do these things that are very distinctly Western, but they do them, you know, sort of from their own history and with their own sort of mythologies and styles. Of course, it's a fucking samurai movie, obviously. It's just... It has everything you want in a 1950s Kurosawa movie, in my opinion. It's a fantastic performance, you know, by his Robert De Niro. Exactly. It's just everything about Throne of Blood, I just think, is completely kick-ass. And I really cannot recommend it highly enough. Jason, what's your favorite movie from 57 other than Sweet Smell of Success?
Right. Well, yeah, that may be it. But I decided to go with, you know, another lighthearted romp. To the themes of the show, Lionel Rogerson's On the Bowery, which is an incredible sort of early fusion of sort of, you know, documentary technique, non-actors, in a narrative story. Basically, Lionel Rogerson wanted to tell a story about the drunks and forgotten men of New York's Bowery. So he went and shot it entirely on location there, which, as James mentioned with Sweet Smell, was not commonplace at the time. Got some kind of non-actors and tells this really sort of heart-wrenching story about just a guy who's down there who's trying to get on his feet and, you know, makes a friend and doesn't work out so well. It's sort of like a mumblecore Midnight Cowboy, but, you know, 50 years before mumblecore was a thing. It's just a terrific piece of work. Thank you again, James.
Thank you. Real pleasure being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very